His name made him appear. The baseball game on television was interrupted by a special message from the Cuban president. Fidel Castro was an old man with liver spots on his forehead, gray hair, a big bushy gray beard, and bags under his eyes. He wore the same thing he did every time he was on television, a green military jacket and flat round cap, and sat behind a row of microphones. Everyone got quiet as Lito turned up the volume. Castro condemned the violence that had broken out on the Malecón, blaming it on U.S. agents. Papi scoffed.
It wasn't U.S. agents. It was hungry Cubans.
Castro rambled on without a script, quoting novels and telling personal anecdotes about the revolution.
Oh, turn it off, Papi said.
But before Mami had reached the set, Castro said something that made them all sit up and listen.
We cannot continue guarding the borders of the United States while they send their CIA to instigate riots in Havana. That is when incidents like this occur, and the world calls the Cuban government cruel and inhumane. And so, until there is a speedy and efficient solution, we are suspending all obstacles so that those who wish to leave Cuba may do so legally, once and for all. We will not stand in their way.
What did he just say?
Mommy asked. Papi's eyes were wide as he stood from the kitchen table.
Castro just said anybody who wants to can leave.
Isabel felt as though her heart had been ripped out of her chest. If Castro was letting anyone leave, her father would be gone before the sun rose the next day. She could see it in his wild look.
You can't go now, Lito told Papi. You have a family to take care of, a wife, a daughter, a son on the way.
Isabel's father and grandfather yelled at each other about dictators and freedom and families and responsibility. Lito was her mother's father, and he and Papi had never gotten along. Isabel covered her ears and stepped away. She had to think of some answer to all this, some solution that would keep her family together. Then she had it.
We'll all go,
Isabel cried. That shut everybody up. Even Castro stopped talking, and the TV went back to showing the baseball game.
No,
Papi and Lito said at the same time.
Why not?
Isabel said.
Your mother is pregnant for one thing, Lito said.
There's no food to feed the baby here anyway, Isabel said. There's no food for any of us, and no money to buy it with if there was. But there is food in the States, and freedom, and work,
and a place where her father wouldn't be beaten or arrested, or run away.
We'll all go, while Castro is letting people out,
she went on.
Lito, too.
What? But I... No.
Lito protested. They were all quiet a moment more, until her father said,
But I don't even have a boat.
Isabel nodded. She could fix that, too. Without saying anything, Isabel ran next door to the Castillo's house. Luis, the older boy who'd saved her from the policeman's nightstick, wasn't home from work yet, and neither was his mother, Juaneta, who worked at the cooperative law office. But Isabel found Ivan and his father, Rudy, right where she thought they'd be, working on their boat in the shed. It was an ugly blue thing cobbled together out of old metal advertisements and road signs and oil drums. It barely qualified as a boat, but it was big enough for the four Castillos, and maybe four more guests.
Well, if it isn't Hurricane Isabel,
Señor Castillo said. He had white hair that he wore swept back on his head, and even though there was no food, he had a middle-aged paunch to his belly.
You have to take us with you, Isabel said.
No, we don't,
Señor Castillo said.
Ivan, Nail.
People are rioting in Havana, Isabel said.
Tell me something I don't know, Señor Castillo said. Ivan, nail.
Ivan handed him another nail. My father was almost arrested, Isabel said. If you don't take us with you, they'll throw him in prison.
Señor Castillo paused his hammering for a moment, then shook his head.
There's no room. And we don't need a fugitive on board.
Ivan looked at him funny, but only Isabel saw it.
Please, Isabel begged. We don't have any gasoline anyway, Ivan said.
He put a hand to the motorcycle motor they'd mounted inside the boat.
We're not going anywhere soon. I can fix that, Isabel said.
She ran home again. Her father and grandfather were still arguing in the kitchen, so she slipped in the back way. She grabbed her trumpet, gave it one long, sad look, and ran out the back door. She was already in the street when she stopped, ran to her backyard, and snatched up the little mewling kitten, too. With the trumpet in one arm and the kitten in the other, she ran the few blocks to the beach, where she banged on the door of a fisherman her grandfather knew. His gas-powered fishing boat rocked gently at a little pier nearby. The fisherman came to his door, licking his fingers and frowning. Isabel had caught him at dinner. Fried fish, it smelled like. The kitten's nose sniffed eagerly at the air, and it meowed. Isabel's stomach growled.
You're Mariano Padron's granddaughter, aren't you?
The fisherman said.
What do you want?
I need gasoline, Isabel told him.
Is that so? Well, I need money.
I don't have any money, Isabel said. But I have this.
She held out the trumpet. Isabel regretted that its brass was a little tarnished, but it was the most valuable thing she owned. The fisherman had to take it in trade.
What am I going to do with that?
He asked.
Sell it, Isabel told him. It's French and old and plays like a dream.
The fisherman sighed.
And why do you need gasoline so badly?
To leave Cuba before my father is arrested.
The fisherman wiped his lips on the back of his hand. Isabel stood for what seemed like hours, her insides churning like a waterspout. At last, he reached out and took the trumpet.
Wait here,
he told her. Isabel held her breath, and soon the fisherman came back with two enormous plastic jugs of gasoline. Each one came up to Isabel's chest.
Is it enough? Isabel asked.
To get you to Miami? Yes. And back again.
Isabel's heart soared, and she hopped up and down.
Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you,
Isabel told him.
Oh, and you have to take the kitten, too.
She held the wiggling creature out to him, but the old fisherman just stared at it.
Is that so?
The fisherman said.
Please, Isabel said, or else someone will catch her and eat her. But you have fish to eat. She can eat the scraps.
The fisherman eyed the cat suspiciously.
Is it a good mouser?
Yes,
Isabel said, though she was sure that even a mouse would give the scrawny thing trouble.
Her name is Leona.
The old fisherman sighed and took the squirming kitten from her. Isabel smiled, then noticed how big and heavy the gas cans were.
Oh, and I also need you to help me carry these back.
Mahmoud, Aleppo, Syria, 2015. Through the huge hole that used to be the wall of his apartment, Mahmoud saw gray-white clouds from missile strikes blooming all around. He shook his head, trying to clear the ringing, and spied his little brother. Walid was sitting right where he had been before the attack, on the floor in front of the TV. Only the TV wasn't there anymore. It had fallen 5 stories to the ground below, along with the outside wall. And Walid was centimeters from joining them both.
"Walid, don't move!"
Mahmoud cried. He hurried across the room, his ankles turning painfully on broken bits of wall. Walid sat still as a statue, and he looked like one too. He was covered with a fine gray powder from head to foot, like he'd taken a bath in dry concrete mix. Mahmoud finally reached him, snatching him up and away from the cliff's edge that used to be their wall.
"Walid! Walid, are you okay?"
Mahmoud asked, turning him around. Walid's eyes were alive, but empty.
"Walid, talk to me! Are you all right?"
Walid finally looked up at him. "You're bleeding," was all he said.
"Mahmoud! Walid!"
their mother cried. She staggered to the door of her bedroom, Hannah crying in her arms.
"Oh, thank God you're alive,"
their mom said. She dropped to her knees and pulled them both into a hug. Mahmoud's heart was racing, his ears still buzzed, and his shoulder burned. But they were alive. They were all alive. He felt tears come to his eyes and wiped them away. The floor beneath their feet groaned and shifted.
"We have to get out of here," Mahmoud's mother said,
putting Hannah in Mahmoud's arms.
"Go, go. Take your brother and your sister. I'll be right behind you. I just have to grab a few things."
"Mom, no!"
"Go,"
she told Mahmoud, pushing them all toward the door. Mahmoud clutched Hannah with one arm and took his brother's hand. He dragged Walid with him toward the front door, but Walid pulled back.
"What about my action figures?"
Walid asked. He looked over his shoulder like he wanted to go back for them.
"We'll buy new ones," Mahmoud told him. "We have to get out of here."
Across the hall, the Saraf family filled the corridor. Mother, father, and twin daughters, both younger than Walid.
"What's happened?"
Mr. Saraf asked Mahmoud. And then he saw the missing wall, and his eyes went wide.
"The building's been hit," Mahmoud said. "We have to get out."
Mr. and Mrs. Saraf hurried back into their apartment, and Mahmoud carried Hannah down the stairs, pulling Walid behind them. Halfway to the ground, the building shifted again, and the concrete stairs broke away from the wall, leaving a 5-centimeter crack. Mahmoud grabbed the railing to steady himself and waited a long, breathless moment to see if the stairs were going to collapse. When they didn't, he ran the rest of the way down and burst out onto the street, Hannah still in his arms and his brother right behind them. Rubble was strewn everywhere. Missiles and bombs thudded nearby, close enough to shake loose parts of walls. A building shuddered and collapsed, smoke and debris avalanching out into the street. Mahmoud jumped when it fell, but Walid stood still, like this kind of thing happened every day. With a jolt of surprise, Mahmoud realized this kind of thing did happen every day. Just not to them. Until now. Everywhere around them, people fled into the streets, covered in gray dust and blood. No sirens rang. No ambulances came to help the wounded. No police cars or emergency crews hurried to the scene. There weren't any left. Mahmoud stared up at their building. The whole front had collapsed, and Mahmoud felt like he was looking into a giant dollhouse. Each floor had a living room and a kitchen just like theirs, all decorated differently. The building groaned again, and a kitchen on the top floor began to tip toward the street. It collapsed onto the 6th floor, and then into Mahmoud's apartment, and on down like dominoes. Mahmoud barely had time to yell, "Run!" and drag Walid and his sister away, before the whole building came crashing down into the street, thundering like a jet fighter. Safe on the sidewalk across the street, clutching Hannah and Walid, Mahmoud suddenly realized his mother had still been in the building.
"Mom! Mom!"
Mahmoud yelled.
"Mahmoud? Walid?"
he heard his mother cry, and she came out from behind the pile of rubble with the Saraf family, all of them covered in gray dust. She ran toward Mahmoud and embraced him, Walid, and Hannah.
"We went out the back stairs," she told them, "and just in time."
Mahmoud looked up at where his apartment had been. It wasn't there anymore. His home was totally destroyed. What would they do now? Where would they go? Mahmoud's mother was carrying their school backpacks, and she traded them for Hana. Mahmoud couldn't understand why his mother had bothered to save their backpacks until he saw that they were stuffed with clothes and diapers. She had gone back for whatever she could take from the apartment. Everything they owned was in these two backpacks.
"I can't reach your father," Mahmoud's mother said, thumbing her phone. "There's no service again."
Mahmoud's father was an engineer with a mobile phone company. If the phones were out, he was probably working on trying to fix them. But what if his father had been hit by one of the bombs? Mahmoud's stomach twisted into knots just thinking about it. But then, there his dad was, running down the street toward them, and Mahmoud felt like he could fly.
"Fatima! Mahmoud! Walid! Hana!"
his father cried. He wrapped them all in a hug and kissed little Hana on the forehead.
"Thank God you're all alive," he cried.
"Dad, our house is gone," Mahmoud told him. "What do we do?"
"What we should have done a long time ago. We're leaving Aleppo. Now. I parked the car nearby. We can be in Turkey by tomorrow. We can sell the car there and make our way north, to Germany."
Everyone stopped while Mahmoud's father walked ahead.
"Germany?" Mahmoud's mother said.
Mahmoud felt as stunned as his mother sounded. Germany? He remembered the map of the world that hung in his classroom. Germany was somewhere up north in the heart of Europe. He couldn't imagine traveling that far.
"Just for a little while," Mahmoud's father said. "I saw on the TV they're accepting refugees. We can stay there until all this is over. Until we can come back home."
"It's cold in Germany," Mahmoud said.
"Do you want to build a snowman?" his father sang.
They had seen Frozen in a movie theater, back when they could get to the now government-controlled side of the city that had theaters.
"Yusuf," Mahmoud's mom warned.
Mahmoud's dad looked sheepish.
"It doesn't have to be a snowman."
"This is serious," Mom said. "I know we've been talking about leaving, but now, like this? We were going to pack, plan, buy tickets, book hotel rooms. All we have now are two backpacks and our phones. Germany is a long way away. How will we get there?"
"By car first," Mahmoud's father shrugged. "Then by boat, by train, by bus, on foot, I don't know. What choice do we have? Our home is destroyed. Were you able to get the cash we put away?"
Mahmoud's mother nodded, but she was clearly still worried.
"So we have money. We will buy tickets as we go. More importantly, we have our lives. But if we stay in Aleppo a day longer, we may not even have that."
Mahmoud's father looked from his wife, to Hana, to Mahmoud, to Walid.
"We've spent too much time talking about it and not doing anything. It's not safe here. It hasn't been for months, years. We should have gone long ago. Ready or not, if we want to live, we have to leave Syria."
Joseph. Somewhere on the Atlantic Ocean, 1939. 6 days from home. Ruthie skipped ahead of Joseph along the sunny promenade deck, happier than he'd ever seen her before. And why not? The MS St. Louis was a paradise. Banned from movie theaters in Germany because she was a Jew, Ruthie had seen her first cartoon on board during movie night and loved it, even if it was followed by a newsreel with Hitler yelling about Jews. 3 times a day, they ate delicious meals in a dining room laid out with white linen tablecloths, crystal glasses, and shining silverware, and stewards waited on them hand and foot. They had played shuffleboard and badminton, and the crew was putting up a swimming pool, which they promised to fill with seawater once the St. Louis hit the warm Gulf Stream. Everyone on the crew had treated Joseph and his family with kindness and respect, despite his father's repeated warnings that all Germans were out to get them. In 5 days, Papa hadn't come out of their cabin once, not even for meals, and Joseph's mother had barely left his side. And the crew wasn't just being nice because they didn't know Joseph and his family were Jews. No one wore their Jewish armbands on the ship, and there were no J's above any of the passenger compartments because all the passengers were Jews, all 908 of them. They were all going to Cuba to escape the Nazis, and now that they were finally away from the threats and violence that followed them everywhere in Germany, there was singing and dancing and laughter. Two girls around Ruthie's age, wearing matching flowery dresses, were leaning over the railing and giggling. Joseph and Ruthie went over to see what they were doing. One of the girls had found a long piece of string and was dangling it over the side, tickling the noses of passengers who were sleeping in chairs down on A deck. Their current victim kept batting at his nose like there was a fly on it. He bopped his nose hard enough to jerk awake, and Ruthie laughed hysterically. The girls yanked up the string, and they all dropped to the deck behind the rail where the man couldn't see them laughing. "I'm Joseph," he told the other girls when they'd all gathered themselves together. "And this is Ruthie." "Joseph just turned 13," Ruthie told the girls. "He's going to have his bar mitzvah next Shabbos." A bar mitzvah was the ceremony at which a boy officially became a man under Jewish law. It was usually held on the first Shabbos, the Sabbath, the Jewish day of rest, after a boy's 13th birthday. Joseph couldn't wait for his bar mitzvah. "If there's enough people," Joseph reminded his sister. "I'm Renata Aber," said the older of the two girls, "and this is Evelina." They were sisters, and amazingly, they were traveling alone. "Our father is waiting for us in Cuba," Renata told them. "Where's your mama?" Ruthie asked. "She wanted to stay in Germany," Evelina said. Joseph could tell it wasn't something they were comfortable talking about. "Hey, I know something funny we can do," he told them. It was a trick he and Klaus had played on Herr Meyer once upon a time. Thinking about Klaus made Joseph think about other things, but he blinked away the bad memories. The MS St. Louis had left all that behind. "First," Joseph said, "we need some soap." Once they had found a bar, Joseph showed them how to soap up a door handle so that it was so slick it was impossible to turn. They used it on the door handles of cabins up and down the passageway on A deck, then hid around the corner and waited. Soon enough, a steward balancing a large silver tray came down the hall from the other end and knocked on a door. Joseph, Ruthie, Renata, and Evelina had to swallow their Snickers as the steward reached down with his free hand and tried and failed to open the door. The steward couldn't see because of the big platter he held, and as he fumbled with a knob, he lost his hold on the tray, and the whole thing came crashing down with a great clatter. All four of them burst out laughing, and Joseph and Renata pulled the two younger children away before they could be caught. They collapsed behind one of the lifeboats, panting and giggling. As Joseph dried his eyes, he realized he hadn't played like this, hadn't laughed like this, for many years. Joseph wished they could stay on board the St. Louis forever.
Isabel. Just outside Havana, Cuba, 1994. The boat was heavy in Isabel's arms, and she was afraid of dropping it, even though there were five other people carrying it with her. She and Iván held the middle of the boat on either side, while Iván's parents and Isabel's father and grandfather carried the front and back. Señora Castillo, Iván's mother, was dark-skinned and curvy, and wore a white kerchief over her dreadlocks. Isabel's mother, almost 9 months pregnant, was the only one not helping to carry the boat. It was big and heavy to begin with, and they had packed it with the gas cans, plastic soda bottles filled with fresh water, condensed milk, cheese and bread, and medicine. Everything else had to be left behind. Nothing was more important than making it to Florida. It was night, and a waning moon peeked out from behind scattered clouds. A warm breeze lifted Isabel's short, curly hair and raised goosebumps on her arms. Fidel Castro had said that anyone who wanted to leave was welcome to go, but that was hours ago. What if he had changed his mind? What if there was a line of police waiting to arrest them at the beach? Isabel hefted the boat to get a better grip and tried to pick up her pace. They left the village's gravel road and hauled the boat over the dunes to the sea. All Isabel could see was the metal side of the boat in front of her face, but she heard a commotion behind her. There were people on the beach. Lots of them. She panicked, her worst fears come true, and suddenly a blinding light lit her up.
Isabel cried out and let go of the boat.
Ahead of her, Señora Castillo staggered and lost her grip too, and the front of the boat slammed into the sand. Isabel turned, holding a hand up in front of her eyes, and expecting to see a police searchlight shining on her. What she saw instead was a television camera.
"You're on CNN,"
a woman said in Spanish, her face nothing but a silhouette against the light.
"Can you tell us what made you decide to leave?"
"Quickly,"
Señor Castillo called from the other side of the boat.
"Pick it back up. We're almost to the water."
"I..."
Isabel said, frozen in the bright light of the camera.
"Do you have any relatives back in Miami that you want to send a message to?"
the reporter asked.
"No, we..."
"Isabel, the boat!"
Papi called. The others had already lifted the boat up out of the sand and were lurching toward the sound of the crashing waves. The bright lights of the camera swung away from Isabel and lit up what looked like a party on the beach. More than half their village was on the sand, clapping, waving, and cheering on the boats. And there were so many boats. Isabel's family had worked in secret all night with the Castillos, worried someone might hear them, but apparently everybody else had been doing the same thing. There were inflatable rafts, canoes with homemade outriggers, rafts made of inner tubes tied together, boats built out of styrofoam and oil drums. A rickety-looking raft made out of wooden shipping pallets and inner tubes raised a bedsheet sail, and as it caught the wind, the villagers on the beach cheered. When another raft made out of an old refrigerator sank, everyone laughed. The camera lights swung around again, and that's when Isabel saw the police. There was a small group of them, up on the rocks overlooking the inlet. Not nearly as many as there had been in Havana, but enough. Enough to arrest her family for trying to leave Cuba. But these police weren't doing anything. They were just standing and watching. Castro's order to let people leave must have still been good.
"Chabela,"
her mother called.
"Chabela, come on."
Mommy was already in the boat, and Papi was helping Iván in. Señor Castillo was trying to get the motor started. Isabel waded into the water, the waves lapping up to the bottom of her shorts. She was almost to Poppy's outstretched arms when she saw her father's eyes go wide. Isabel looked back over her shoulder. Two of the policemen had broken from the group and were running toward the water. Toward them.
"No, no! They're coming for me!"
Poppy cried. Isabel fell into the water and swam the rest of the way to the boat, but her father was already climbing over the side.
"Start the engine," he cried.
"No, wait for me,"
Isabel yelled, spitting seawater. She got a hand to the side of the boat and looked back. The two policemen had hit the surf and were running high-legged through the waves. Worse, the other policemen were running too, and they were all headed for the Castillos' boat. Hans grabbed Isabel and helped her climb the side of the boat. Iván. But when he got her aboard, Iván and his mother then reached their hands out for the two policemen who were chasing them. What were they doing?
"No!"
Papi cried, scrambling as far away from them as he could. Iván and Señora Castillo grabbed the arms of the two policemen and pulled them on board, and they all collapsed into the bottom of the boat. The policemen pulled off their berets, and Isabel recognized one of them instantly. One was Luis, the Castillos' elder son. The other policeman shook out his long black hair, and Isabel was startled to realize it wasn't a policeman at all. It was a policewoman. When she took Luis's hand, Isabel guessed she was his girlfriend. This must have been the Castillos' plan all along, for Luis and his girlfriend to run away with them. But they had never told Isabel and her family. Pack. A pistol rang out again over the waves, and the crowd on the beach cried out in panic. The pistol fired again, pack, and ping. The hull of the Castillos' boat rang as the bullet hit it. The police were shooting at them. But why? Didn't Castro say it was all right to leave? Isabel's eyes fell on Luis and his girlfriend, and she understood. They had been drafted into the police, and they weren't allowed to leave. They were deserters, and deserters were shot. The motor coughed to life, and the boat lurched into a wave, spraying Isabel with seawater. The villagers on the beach cheered for them, and Señor Castillo revved the engine, leaving the charging policemen in their wake. Isabel braced herself between two of the benches, trying to catch her breath. It took her a moment to process it, but this was really happening. They were leaving Cuba, her village, her home, everything she'd ever known, behind. Isabel's father pitched across the roiling boat and grabbed Señor Castillo by the shirt.
"What are you playing at letting them on board?" he demanded. "What if they follow us? What if they send a Navy boat after us? You've put us all in danger."
Señor Castillo batted Geraldo Fernandez's arms away.
"We didn't ask you to come along. It's our gasoline,"
Isabel's father yelled. They kept arguing, but the engine and the slap of the boat against the waves drowned their words out for Isabel. She wasn't paying any attention anyway. All she could think about was the 90 miles they still had to go, and the water pouring in from the gunshot hole in the side of the boat.
Mahmoud, just outside Aleppo, Syria, 2015, one day from home. Mahmoud's father stopped their Mercedes station wagon for gasoline at a little roadside station north of Aleppo. Walid and Mahmoud sat in the car with their mother while she nursed Hana under a blanket. Fatima had put on a black long-sleeved dress and a pink flowery hijab that covered her head and shoulders. She and Yusuf had agreed she should cover up more than she usually did in Aleppo in case they ran into stricter Muslims outside the city. In some places, women were being stoned and killed for not covering up their entire bodies, especially in areas controlled by Daesh, what the rest of the world called ISIS. Daesh thought they were fighting the final war of the apocalypse, and anyone who didn't agree with their twisted perversion of Islam were infidels who should have their heads cut off. Mahmoud and his family planned to stay as far away from Daesh as possible, but the radical fighters were coming farther and farther into Syria every day. Mahmoud looked out the dusty car window as a jet fighter streaked by, high above them, headed for Aleppo. A mural painted on the side of the gas station showed President Assad, his dark hair cut short and a thin mustache underneath his pointy nose. He wore a suit and tie in front of a Syrian flag, doves of peace and yellow shining light surrounding him. A jagged line of real bullet holes bisected Assad's face. Mahmoud's father got back in the car.
"I've got a route for us," Mom said.
She finally had a signal and got Google Maps to open on her iPhone. Mahmoud leaned over to see.
"This route crosses a country border," Google Maps told them, marking the alert with a little yellow triangle.
That's what they wanted, to get out of Syria using the fastest path possible. Dad started the engine, put the car into gear, and they were off. An hour later, they were met on the road by four soldiers waving for them to stop. Mahmoud froze. The soldiers might be with the Syrian army or with the Syrian rebels. They could even be Daesh. It was hard to tell anymore. Some of these soldiers wore camouflage pants and shirts, but others wore Adidas jerseys and leather jackets and track pants. They all had short black beards like Mahmoud's father and wore headscarves of different colors and patterns. But each of them had an automatic rifle, which was really all that mattered.
"Your hijab," Dad said, "quickly."
Mahmoud's mother pulled the end of the scarf up over her face so that only her eyes were showing. Mahmoud sank to the floor of the old Mercedes station wagon and tried to disappear. In the seat beside him, Walid sat up straight next to his open window, unmoving and unfazed. "Everybody stay calm," Dad said, slowing the car down, "and let me do all the talking." One of the soldiers stood in front of the car, his rifle aimed loosely at the windshield, while the others walked around the sides, peering in through the windows. The soldiers were silent, and Mahmoud closed his eyes tight, waiting for the shots to come. Sweat ran down his back. "I'm just trying to get my family to safety," Dad told the men. One of the men stopped at the driver's side window and pointed his rifle at Mahmoud's father. "Which side do you support?" The question was as dangerous as his gun. The right answer, and they lived. The wrong answer, and they all died. But what was the right answer? Assad and the Syrian army? The rebels? Daesh? His dad hesitated, and Mahmoud held his breath. One of the soldiers cocked his rifle. Ch-chack! It was Walid who spoke up. "We're against whoever is dropping the bombs on us," he said. The soldier laughed, and the other soldiers laughed with him. "We're against whoever is dropping the bombs too," the soldier at the window said, "which is usually that dog Assad." Mahmoud breathed again with relief. Walid didn't know it, but he'd saved the day. "Where are you going?" the soldier at the window asked. "North," Dad said, "through Azaz." The soldier opened the back door of the car and slid inside, pushing Walid into the back of the station wagon. "No, no, you can't go through Azaz anymore," the soldier said. "The Free Syria Army and Al-Qaeda are fighting there now." The door next to Mahmoud opened, and one of the soldiers nudged him up from the floor and into the back with Walid. Two more soldiers crammed themselves into the back seat, and the last one joined Mahmoud and Walid in the back with their backpacks. He was dusty and smelled like he hadn't had a bath in months, and the heat of the road radiated off him and his rifle like a stove. Apparently, they were all coming along for the ride. One of the soldiers in the back seat snatched up Mom's iPhone and looked at the route.
"Use Apple Maps," another soldier said.
"No, you idiot. Google Maps is better," said his friend. "See here," he told Mahmoud's father. "You'll have to go over to Katma and then north through Castel Sindo. The rebels and the army and Daesh are all fighting here," he said, pointing to places on the map. "Many guns and artillery. And the Kurds hold all this territory here. Russian airstrikes have hit here and here in support of that Alawite pig, Assad. And American drones are attacking Daesh here and here." Mahmoud's eyes went wide. Everything the soldier was describing stood between them and Turkey. "Go back south," one of the soldiers told Mahmoud's father. "You can let us off at Highway 214. Dad turned the car around and drove. The soldier with the iPhone scrolled up the map to see their destination. "You're going to Turkey?"
I went to engineering school there," Mahmoud's father said.
"You shouldn't be leaving Syria," said one of the soldiers. "You should stand up for your country. Fight the tyrant Assad."
Between Assad and Daesh and Russia and America, Mahmoud thought, there wasn't much of a Syria left to fight for.
"I just want to keep my family safe," Dad said.
"My family was killed in an airstrike," one of the soldiers said. "Maybe when yours is too, you'll take up arms. But by then, it will be too late."
Mahmoud remembered the horror he'd felt when his apartment building collapsed, and he thought his mom was still inside. The fear he'd felt when they couldn't reach his father. If his parents had died in the airstrike, would he want revenge on their killers? Instead of running away, should Mahmoud and his father join the rebels and fight to win their country back? Mahmoud's dad kept driving. They were almost to the highway when gunfire erupted nearby.
Tat! Tat-tat-tat-tat! Tat-tat-tat!
And bullets pinged into the car. Mahmoud screamed and dropped to the floor as broken glass sprayed him. One of the back tires exploded, and the car swerved wildly and screeched as his dad fought to keep control of it. Mahmoud and Walid went tumbling, and the soldier in the back rolled on top of them. The soldier had a hole in his head.
Mahmoud screamed again and pushed the man away as the car skidded to a stop. Bullets whizzed by, then caught the car again. Ping, ping, ping! And Mahmoud's dad threw open the driver's side door and pulled Mom and Hannah out with him. Get out of the car! He cried. The soldiers in the back seat kicked open the door on the left side of the car and spilled outside. More bullets whizzed by overhead, and soon the rebel soldiers who had been riding with them were returning fire, their automatic rifles booming in Mahmoud's ears like he was in a barrel, and they were beating on the outside of it with hammers. All Mahmoud wanted to do was curl up into a ball and disappear. But he knew if he and Walid stayed in the car, they would end up like the dead soldier beside them. He had to get up, get out, move. His heart was pounding so hard he thought it would burst right out of his chest. But Mahmoud found the courage to grab Walid by the arm, drag him over the seat, and dive headfirst out the door. They tumbled into the ditch beside his parents. Hannah was wailing, but Mahmoud almost couldn't hear her over the sound of the gunfire. Mahmoud's dad waited for a pause in the gunfire, then scrambled back up the ridge for the car.
Yusuf, no! Mom cried. What are you doing?
Mahmoud's father dove back into the front seat and yanked the iPhone and the charger cord from the Mercedes just as bullets ripped into the car again. He tumbled and slid back down into the ditch.
Had to go back for the phone, he told them. How else am I going to play Angry Birds?
He was joking again. Mahmoud knew they needed their phones to help them get to Turkey. Without the maps, they'd be lost. Mahmoud's father waited for another lull in the shooting, and then they all hurried away from the car, leaving everything else they owned behind.
Joseph. Somewhere on the Atlantic Ocean, 1939. 8 days from home. Finally, Shabbos arrived. It was the day Joseph would leave his childhood behind and become a man, and he could hardly contain his excitement. The ship's bulletin board announced that the first-class social hall would be converted to a synagogue, a Jewish house of prayer, which meant Joseph might have his bar mitzvah after all. He was careful not to show his eagerness in front of his father, however. What would once have been a happy occasion in the Landau home was now fraught with anxiety, thanks to his father's paranoia. A synagogue? On board the ship? Papa said. He shook his head as he paced their little room in his oversized night clothes. The captain himself has arranged it, Mama said. Ridiculous! Did no one else see the Nazi flag overhead as we came on board? Will you not go to your own son's bar mitzvah, then? Joseph's mother and Ruthie were already dressed in their nice Shabbos dresses. Joseph wore his best shirt and tie. Bar mitzvah! There won't be enough men there to form a minion, Papa said. By tradition, 10 or more Jewish men, a minion, was needed for a public service. No, no one who has lived in Germany for the past 6 years would be so foolish as to go to a Jewish service aboard a Nazi ship. Papa ran a hand over his shaved head. No, it's a trap, meant to lure us out. That's when they'll snatch us. A trap. Mama sighed. All right, then. We'll go without you. They left him pacing the room, muttering to himself. Joseph felt like someone had yanked his heart from his chest. In all the times he dreamed of this day, his father had always been there to recite a blessing with him. But maybe this is what becoming a man is, Joseph thought. Maybe becoming a man means not relying on your father anymore. Joseph, his mother, and Ruthie stopped short just inside the first-class social hall. There weren't the required 10 men for the service. There were 100 men, probably more, all wearing yarmulkes on their heads and white and black talisim, prayer shawls around their shoulders. The card tables had been pushed to the sides of the room, and stewards were adding more chairs to accommodate the crowd. A table at the front held a Torah scroll. Joseph stood and stared. It felt like ages since he'd been inside a synagogue. It had been before Kristallnacht, before the Nuremberg laws that made Jews second-class citizens, before the boycotts and book burnings, before Jews were scared to gather together in public places. Joseph's parents had always taken him to synagogue with them on Shabbos, even when other parents left their children with their nannies. It all came flooding back to him now, swaying and humming along with the prayers, craning his neck to see the Torah when it was taken out of the ark, and hoping to get a chance to touch it and then kiss his fingers as the scroll came around in a procession. Joseph felt his skin tingle. The Nazis had taken all this from them, from him, and now he and the passengers on the ship were taking it back. Gustav Schroeder, the ship's diminutive captain, was there to greet them at the door. In the gallery above the room, a number of the off-duty crew had gathered to watch. "Captain," asked a rabbi, one of the men who was leading the service, "I wonder if we might take down the portrait of the Führer, given the circumstances. It seems inappropriate for such a sacred moment to be celebrated in the presence of Hitler." Joseph had seen paintings of the Nazi leader all over the ship, and the first-class social hall was no exception. A large portrait of Hitler hung in the middle of the room, watching over them all. Joseph's veins ran with ice. He hated that man. Hated him because of everything he'd done to the Jews, but mostly because of what Hitler had done to his father.
"Of course," Captain Schroeder said.
He quickly called over two of the stewards, and soon they had the portrait down and were taking it from the room. In the gallery above, Joseph saw one of the crew slam a fist down on the railing and storm off. Joseph's mother gave him a kiss on the cheek, and she and Ruthie went to sit in the section reserved for the women. Joseph took a seat in the section with the men. The rabbi stood in front of the crowd and read from Hosea. Then it was time for Joseph to recite the blessing he'd been practicing for weeks. There were butterflies in his stomach as he got up in front of such a large audience, and his voice broke as he stumbled through the Hebrew words, but he did it. He found his mother in the crowd. Her eyes were wet with tears. "Today," Joseph said, "I am a man." There were many hands to shake and many congratulations after the ceremony, but it was all a blur to Joseph. He felt like he was walking in a dream. For as long as he could remember, he'd wanted this, to no longer be a child, to be an adult. Joseph's mother and sister left to go back to visit his father in their cabin. Joseph walked the promenade deck by himself, a new man. Renata and Evelina jumped out from behind a lifeboat and grabbed Joseph by the hand. Without their parents on the ship, they had skipped synagogue to play.
"Joseph, come stand guard for us," Renata cried.
Before he could protest, the girls dragged him to a women's restroom. He was afraid they were going to pull him inside, but instead they deposited him by the door.
"Yell if you see someone coming," Renata said breathlessly. "We're going to latch all the stalls from the inside and crawl out under the doors so no one can use the toilets." "No, don't," Joseph tried to tell them, but they were already gone.
He stood there awkwardly, not sure if he should stay or go. Soon the sisters ran back outside, hanging on to each other with laughter. A young woman staggered past them, clutching her stomach and looking green. Renata and Evelina got quiet, and Joseph could hear the woman desperately rattling the stall doors, looking for a toilet. The woman lurched out of the bathroom, looking even more green and desperate, and wobbled away. Renata and Evelina burst into laughter. Joseph raised himself up.
"This isn't funny. Go in there and unlock those doors this minute." "Just because you had your bar mitzvah doesn't make you an adult," Renata told him, and Evelina stuck her tongue out at him. "Come on, Evie, let's do the bathrooms on A deck."
The girls tore away, and Joseph huffed. They were right. A bar mitzvah alone didn't make him an adult. Being responsible did. He walked on along the promenade, looking for a steward he could tell about the bathroom stalls. He saw two stewards who had stopped to look over the side at the sea and came up behind them.
"Must be doing 16 knots easy," said one of the stewards. "Captain's got the engines maxed out." "Has to," the other said. "Them other two ships is smaller and faster. They get to Cuba first and unload their passengers, and who knows? Cuba might decide she's full up with Jews when we get there and turn us away."
Joseph looked out to sea. There wasn't another ship on the horizon as far as he could see. What other ships were they talking about? More ships full of refugees? And why did it matter which one got there first? Hadn't everyone on board already applied and paid for visas?
Cuba couldn't turn them away. Could they? One of the stewards shook his head.
There's something they're not telling us, the shipping company. Something they're not telling Schroeder. The captain's in a tight spot, he is. Wouldn't want to be him for all the sugar in Cuba.
Joseph backed away. He'd already forgotten about the stalls in the women's bathroom. If he and his family didn't make it to Cuba, if they weren't allowed in, where would they go?
Isabel. The Straits of Florida. Somewhere north of Cuba. 1994. One day from home. Señor Castillo was in charge of the boat. No one had voted or named him captain, but he had built the boat after all, and he was the one at the rudder, steering it, so that put him in charge. He didn't look happy about it, though. He kept frowning at the motor and the rudder like there was something wrong, but besides a quick patch job of stuffing a sock into the bullet hole, everything was good. The lights of Havana had faded to a speck on the horizon behind them, and they had left all the other boats behind. Isabel clung to the wooden bench she sat on, squeezed in between Iván and her grandfather. Their boat was barely big enough for 7 people, and with Luis and his girlfriend, they were practically sitting on top of each other.
I think it's time we met the other person on board with us,
Isabel's grandfather said. Isabel thought he meant Luis's girlfriend, but instead he pushed some of the sacks of food and jugs of water out of the way and pointed to the bottom of the boat. Staring back up at them was the huge face of Fidel Castro. Luis's girlfriend gasped and then suddenly exploded with laughter. Soon all of them were laughing with her. Isabel laughed so hard her stomach hurt. Even grumpy Señor Castillo chuckled.
I needed something big and thick for the bottom of the boat, he said. And seeing as there were so many signs around with El Presidente's head on them.
It was true. Castro's face was everywhere in Cuba. On billboards, on taxis, in picture frames on schoolroom walls, painted on the sides of buildings. Underneath this painting were the words, Fight against the impossible and win.
Well? Fidel is thick-headed, Luis said.
Isabel put her hands to her mouth, but couldn't help laughing again with everyone else. You weren't allowed to say things like that in Cuba. But they weren't in Cuba anymore, were they?
Do you know what the greatest achievements of the Cuban Revolution are?
Isabel's father asked. Education, public health, and sports, they all said together. It was a constant refrain in Castro's lengthy speeches.
And do you know what the greatest failures are?
He asked.
Breakfast, lunch, and dinner,
the adults answered back, as though they'd heard that one many times before, too. Isabel smiled. That prompted someone to break out food and drinks, even though it was late. Isabel sipped from a bottle of soda. How long will it take to get to Florida? She asked. Señor Castillo shrugged.
By tomorrow night, maybe. Tomorrow morning we'll have the sun to guide us.
All that matters now is we get as far away from Cuba as we can, said Luis's girlfriend.
And what is your name, pretty one?
Lito asked her. Amara, she said. She was very pretty, even in her blue police uniform. She had flawless olive skin, long black hair, and full red lips.
No, 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 Lito said.
He fanned his face.
Your name must be Summer, because you're making me sweat.
The girl smiled, but Isabel's mother slapped Lito on the leg.
Papi, stop it. You're old enough to be her grandfather.
Lito just took that as a challenge. He put his hands over his heart.
I wish I was your favorite song, he told Amara, so I could be on your lips forever. If your eyes were the sea, I would drown in them.
Lito was giving her piropos, the flirtatious compliments Cuban men said to women on the street. Not everyone did it anymore, but to Lito it was like an art form. Amara laughed,
and Luis smiled.
Maybe we shouldn't talk about drowning,
Papi said, clutching to the side of the boat as they chopped into a wave. What do you think the States will be like? Isabel's mother asked everyone. Isabel had to stop and think about that. What would the United States be like? She hadn't had much time to even imagine it.
Shelves full of food at the store, Senora Castillo said.
Being able to travel anywhere we want, any time we want, said Amara.
I want to be able to choose who I vote for, Luis said.
I want to play baseball for the New York Yankees, Iván said.
I want you to go to college first, his mother told him.
I want to watch American television, Iván said.
The Simpsons.
I'm going to open my own law office, Senora Castillo said.
Isabel listened as everyone listed more and more things they were looking forward to in the States. Clothes, food, sports, movies, travel, school, opportunity. It all sounded so wonderful. But when it came down to it, all Isabel really wanted was a place where she and her family could be together and happy.
What do you think El Norte will be like, Papi?
Isabel asked. Her father looked surprised at the question.
No more ministry of telling people what to think or else, he said. No more getting thrown in jail for disagreeing with the government. But what do you want to do when you get there?
Señor Castillo asked. He hesitated while everyone stared at him, his eyes searching Castro's face on the bottom of the boat, as though there were answers hidden there.
Be free, Papi said finally.
Let's have a song,
Lito said.
Chabela, play us a song on your trumpet.
Isabel's chest tightened. She'd told her parents what